All right. Our fifth case for this morning is Felix against the Wisconsin Department of Transportation. We hear first from Mr. Dill.
Good morning, Your Honors, and may it please the Court. My name is Jesse Dill, and I represent the appellant Eileen Felix. Your Honors, the District Court erred in granting summary judgment for the Wisconsin Department of Transportation for two main reasons. First, the District Court impermissibly weighed or outright ignored direct and circumstantial evidence demonstrating that Ms. Felix was terminated solely on the basis of her disabilities. At the summary judgment stage, this was an inappropriate decision and constitutes reversible error. Secondly,
is there a legitimate distinction to be drawn, do you think, between behavior in the workplace and the underlying disability that causes that behavior?
Yes, Your Honor. And what Ms. Felix isn't advocating that an employer cannot terminate based on behavior in the workplace. What she's saying here is that there's direct and circumstantial evidence that that's not the reason that she was terminated. Rather, it was her mental disabilities, which actually takes me further into my first point. What the district court did not cite in its opinion that was raised in opposition to summary judgment were the June 25th, 2013 meeting notes between DOT officials. That meeting involved Maya Rudd and Rebecca English, who is DOT's medical coordinator and a key participant in the decision to terminate Ms. Felix. Those meeting notes recorded that DOT, quote, will move to medical separation, end quote, with Ms. Felix. That's the only basis for terminating Ms. Felix described in these notes. For example, there is no reference to her past behavior in these notes. It's only the medical separation.
My question was very similar to Judge Rovner's, though. Certainly to be entitled to keep the job, one has to be otherwise qualified for it. And some people with disabilities are, and accommodations can be made, and other people with disabilities are not otherwise qualified. And there certainly was this incident at the workplace, and I'm having trouble finding anything in this record that suggests that the responsible people didn't genuinely believe that Ms. Felix was not otherwise qualified for this job that she had.
Sure, Your Honors. There's multiple pieces of evidence that at least create a genuine issue of material fact as to whether she was qualified for this position.
So do you think that the position required sitting in the car while the on-road test for a driver's license was underway?
Yes, Your Honor. In fact, Ms. Felix does that job today. She's works for a private driving school in the same position as she did for DOT, doing much of the same duties and responsibilities. Moreover, she had this position for years, and prior to her termination, her treating physician had certified both orally and in writing that she was safe to return to the workplace.
But she'd had this incident. I mean, I guess, how's the department supposed to know she isn't going to have another incident like that in the middle of driving with a 16-year-old in the car?
Sure, Your Honor. They know if one option is to have her go through what we have as the direct threat analysis. They have certain burdens to meet if they believe she's a safety risk for the future. And that's an important distinction that the Ninth Circuit has recently drawn in the Mayo versus PCC Structurals case, is when an employer is acting on the basis of past behavior, that isn't subject to a direct threat analysis. But when they're concerned about risk for future behavior, that decision is then subject to direct threat, and we have a specific heightened standard. And the reason we have that heightened standard is, as the Supreme Court addressed in the Chevron USA Inc. versus Achazabal case, is we don't want stereotypes for people with disabilities and decisions in employment to be made on the basis of stereotypes. So we require this heightened standard for under direct threat analysis for an individualized assessment that has to identify the specific job duties and responsibilities that the individual cannot safely perform, and it must be based on a reasonable medical judgment that takes into consideration the most current medical knowledge or the best available objective evidence.
And her conduct on April 18th was more than a stereotype knee-jerk reaction. I mean, the reaction by her employer was to work through a nice process and carefully determine whether or not she was otherwise qualified.
Sure, Your Honor, but there's evidence in the record that demonstrates that she wasn't terminated on the basis of that behavior. Rather, it was her medical disabilities. There's the meeting notes that I previously discussed between the DOT officials citing a medical separation. There's the conversation that Dr. Beld had with Ms. English that same day where he certified that she was safe to return to work, and he observed that Ms. English held a, quote, shocking level of stigmatization against Ms. Felix on the basis of her mental illness. Furthermore, what's not in the district court opinion is the notice that Ms. Felix received from DOT itself, which cites that it was acting pursuant to the state's medical separation statute.
Well, if they thought she was mentally unstable enough to hold the job, it doesn't shock me that they would call that a medical separation. They were distinguishing. They weren't saying, apparently, I guess she'd had some other issues with the keeping the financial records straight, but it's actually a, you know, not the worst ground they could cite for separating her.
But it's not a lawful ground, Your Honor.
What, medical? Sure, medical is a lawful ground.
We have the Rehabilitation Act to prevent decisions from being based on disabilities. And here it's a mental disability. It's but no different than a physical disability.
No.
But the mental disability can make you not an otherwise qualified individual. So the shorthand used there, how does that create a genuine issue of material fact for a jury?
Because she was in this position for years. Before she was terminated, before the decision to terminate her was made, she had a doctor who was certifying her to return to work. And again, she's doing this job today with driving students around to teach driving instruction. So there's at least a basis for a jury to consider and conclude that she was qualified for the position at the time that the decision was made to terminate her employment.
Mr. Collins, I'd like to ask you something from the brief.
This is Mr. Dill still, Judge Rovner.
I'm sorry. If Ms. Felix is not alleging that the department's reason for discharging her was pretextual, then what jury issue is there? Judge Griesbach seemed to think that she essentially conceded that the department had a genuine, albeit mistaken, concern that she posed a risk to herself or others if she was allowed to return to work. So, I mean, is it your view that a jury should be asked to reevaluate the medical evidence that was before the department's decision makers?
No, Your Honor, and this sort of gets to some of the confusion with the district court's opinion in that the district court said this wasn't a direct threat case, but that didn't recognize that DOT in its principal brief in support of summary judgment repeatedly cited to its decision was based on Ms. Felix as a safety risk. There was 11 times in its principal brief where it said she was a safety risk to herself and others if she were allowed to return to work. That is the direct threat affirmative defense in action. In opposition, Ms. Felix addressed that and demonstrated that there were procedural and substantive issues with DOT asserting that defense. Then in reply, DOT changed its reason for terminating Ms. Felix and instead relied on her past behavior. Despite the remarkable absence of a reference in its principal brief to her past behavior, now it was repeated 16 times in its reply brief that that was the new basis for terminating her employment. This is significant for two reasons, Your Honors. First, the change in reason or change in explanation in itself creates issues of credibility with DOT's explanation. But moreover, this latter reason in the reply brief still has genuine issues of material fact. It's contradictory to the notice that Ms. Felix received from DOT, where they explain that the decision was made on the results of her recent fitness for duty exam and safety concerns in the workplace. So for these reasons, I respectfully request that this court reverse the district court's decision, and I'll respectfully ask to reserve the remainder of my time for rebuttal.
You may do so. Mr. Collins.
Thank you.
I think we've inched into the afternoon, Mr. Collins. So.
May it please the court. I guess good afternoon then.
Yes.
I represent the Department of Transportation. The department respectfully asks this court to affirm the decision of the district court. What this case is about, Your Honors, is the department fulfilling its dual obligations to the public and to its employees.
I wonder if you could address for a minute this direct threat analysis, because it does seem that some of the steps that would be taken if this had been viewed as a direct threat case were not taken here. And so I'd like your thoughts on that.
Yes, Your Honor. We get to direct threat as an affirmative defense only if Ms. Felix has survived summary judgment with establishing the four elements of a Rehabilitation Act claim. What Ms. Felix attempts to do is to short-circuit her own obligations and do an end run around showing that there's a legitimate disputed fact on being qualified or that she was terminated solely by reason of disability.
Don't the facts kind of mix up, though? Because the question of whether she's qualified seems to me, at least here, to rely on some of the underlying data, if you will, some of the underlying events that would also be pertinent to a direct threat analysis. If you're afraid to put her in the car with young people or whatever, that might go to her qualifications too, right?
Yes, Your Honor. Undoubtedly, there's a time where you can have an overlap. I think of direct threat as an affirmative defense versus establishing the four elements of a Rehabilitation Act claim as a bit of a Venn diagram. Certainly, there can be people who fail because they don't show the elements. There can be people who fail on the affirmative defense, and there can be people who fail on both. What is noteworthy about this case, as opposed to some direct threat cases such as Chevron, it comes actually not from the department, but from Ms. Felix's own proposed findings of facts to which the department did not dispute, specifically paragraph 82, where she states that from April 18th to July 15th, 2013, Ms. Felix, quote, could not and did not work at the defendant because her major depressive disorder and anxiety at times were completely incapacitating, and she was virtually unable to function some days. During this time, her breathing, eating, speaking, walking, sleeping, concentrating, communicating, working, thinking, and procreating were significantly, if not completely, limited. So this is not a person who might have a single episode at work that lasts a minute. And then the question becomes, can this person safely function? This may not be a case like Chevron, where a person is completely qualified. And it's only because, I believe, he had hepatitis C and it would be aggravated by working on an oil refinery. It had nothing to do with his ability to do the job. He was fired in that case, or not given the position, solely because of disability. There, the employer had no choice but to rely on the affirmative defense. Here, it's an undisputed...
I'm sorry. Finish your thought. I'm sorry.
Here it's an undisputed fact that she was not just partially but completely unqualified for this period of time. And the question then became whether or not the department was going to accept just a sort of cursory note from her doctor that doesn't even say she's safe. In fact, that's a misrepresentation of the record. The letter in its entirety says, quote, please allow my patient to return to work starting July 15th, 2013. In contrast, the independent medical examiner had laid out a specific analysis and worked through the reasons why nothing had changed to the point where she would now become qualified when she was not previously.
What does the record tell us about the depth of Dr. Burback's evaluation and what information he had from Ms. Felix's physicians and counselors? And was his examination of Ms. Felix really only 30 minutes long?
I apologize, you know, I don't recall the specific duration, but I want to back up and look at the timeline. What we have here is the department telling Ms. Felix on April 22nd that you need to complete this Family Medical Leave Act form. She doesn't get it back to them. She doesn't provide them with the information. They then inform her on May 8th, giving her several weeks' notice, 20 days' notice, about the independent medical exam, and strongly recommending that she brings paperwork with her from her providing treatment individuals. She provides none of that. Instead, she comes, I believe, with some forms or just waivers saying you can seek the records yourself. Of course, when the records later come in at a much later date, they're treatment records from 2011, 2012 that provide no information about 2013. And I can get in a moment on the chronology about what actually is shown in 2013. But they then continue to work with her. And so the independent medical examiner worked through the material. This was not a person who was employed by the department. The department went out to get an independent medical examination. And they didn't stop there. They continue working with Ms. Felix. And when her doctor, Dr. Bell, submits a form. He signs it May 10th and leaves the entire section blank that says, describe the medical facts that support your certification. They don't just dismiss it. They work with Ms. Felix. They work with Dr. Bell. On June 6th, they tell her, look, this form is incomplete. Please get it to us, I believe, by the 17th. The 17th of June comes and goes. Ms. Felix nor her doctor provides any additional information. And then ultimately, what we get from Dr. Bell on the 19th and 24th is nothing that says she's safe to return to work. One is a cursory, please let my patient come to work. And the other is a partially illegible form, but the parts that are legible, and this is all shown in the 25th record, which is the stipulated facts, he writes, current work environment worsens the above. The above is the illegible part. Chronic condition requiring treatment, suggestive that it's ongoing, as chronic. And there is no treatment plan provided. There's just a cursory statement about medical management. It's noteworthy when we actually get to Dr. Bell's notes, which he devises from actually two Skype sessions with her, one lasting 18 minutes and one lasting 22 minutes. First, the first Skype session on May 21st, Ms. Felix tells him, I kind of fainted or something, in her description. Dr. Bell doesn't ask for and actually turns down an opportunity to see the independent medical examiner's report. And then, when he meets with her on the 18th, he notes that she's only doing well or she's doing better because she's not at her job, and her job creates a lot of stress. And so that's what we have from Dr. Bell, and that's the best that she prevents to allege that there's a material fact.
He's the one who's in Utah, isn't he?
That's the one who she teleconferences him with, yeah. Once in for 18 minutes and once for 22 seconds. What's noteworthy, or 22 minutes, what's noteworthy is that Dr. Bell first says, let my patient come back to work on a form he signs on the 10th of May, and yet he doesn't even see her till the 21st of May. So he doesn't even have a one-minute Skype session with her before he's saying she can go back to work. What's noteworthy is her own Counselor Pilon, and I think the brief does not accurately reflect the undisputed facts from Ms. Felix. Counselor Pilon says on his May 31st appointment, she will not return to her former job, and describes a, quote, wave of anxiety when she even looked at the exterior of the building over a month later. On June 14th, her counselor says, quote, she has no plans to return there, end quote, and also describes her as being totally dysregulated, even seeing the building on two occasions. There is nothing in this record, there's no disputed material fact that she was qualified to come back to work, that she was safe to come back to work. And that is why it was appropriate to issue summary judgment, because the reality is Ms. Felix was not qualified. It's an end run. It's a way to sort of shift attention to claim that this is a direct threat case. This case is in line with Palmer. It's in line with Doe. She simply was not qualified. And the other point here is that she was not terminated solely by reason of disability. This court has repeatedly said that an employer can consider the mental illness when it creates the underlying event. But the dispositive issue is whether she's terminated solely by reason of disability, not whether the outward conduct was a consequence of that disability. And so if you look at the complete record here, what we have is a record that shows she was not terminated solely by reason of disability. Ms. Felix relies on a state statute and creates the novel argument that somehow if you comply with state statute, you violate the Rehabilitation Act. But the reality is that's not the case. The statute in question says that the person's being let go on a medical separation because they're incapable or unfit to effectively perform the duties. The person is no longer qualified. If we look to the other alleged disputed facts, the timing here was not suspicious at all, because what we have is a clear timeline. This is very distinguishable from a case like Wright, where the employer let the worker still work for two more months seeing patients and then said, oh, by the way, your conduct from back then makes you unqualified. The employer did everything proper. They immediately stopped her working. They took her off her caseload, and she did not return to work. And I want to note, just in regards to a point raised by opposing counsel, that the allegation that there's a disputed fact because of a statement by Ms. English on June 25th. First of all, the department objected to that even being admissible because it's impermissible opinion evidence that a doctor deduces from a single telephone call when he has never previously talked to or spoken to this person. I see my time's expired. May I briefly conclude?
You may conclude, yes.
And even if we were to somehow accept that that was admissible, this court has said in cases such as Silk that a person must offer more than a mere scintilla of evidence to survive summary judgment. We simply do not have that information, and the court properly granted summary judgment in favor of the department. Thank you.
All right, thank you. Anything further, Mr. Dill? I think you have about a minute.
Sure, Your Honor. It's just a couple of brief points. Whether Ms. Felix was qualified wasn't even addressed by the district court. The district court's opinion was that she was terminated on the basis of behavior. And again, there are genuine issues of material fact with that conclusion through the meeting notes, the conversation with Dr. Bell, and the termination notice that Ms. Felix received from DOT. I think the important question for the court to consider in this case is, what if Dr. Burbach had said yes? I don't think the state has a decision where they terminate Ms. Felix then, because they were relying on Dr. Burbach's report. So up until that time, they thought she was qualified. And Dr. Burbach's report was the reason that they ended up terminating her. But there are genuine issues of material fact with Dr. Burbach's report for the state to rely on that report. He evaluated Ms. Felix for 30 minutes. It was scheduled for over 4 hours, but it was only a 30-minute interview. His report admittedly did not take into consideration her medical records based on her... I'm sorry, may I finish?
Please finish, yeah.
Didn't take into consideration her medical records as to her current course of treatment, and his report admitted that if he got those records, which he had access to, authority to access, but did not, his opinion may have changed. So for those reasons, I respectfully request this court reverse the district court's decision and remand this case for trial. Thank you.
All right. Thank you very much. Thanks to both counsel. We'll take the case under advisement.